Right, well, welcome to Spotlight once again, introduced by me, Steve, in the centre of England here. And first of all, as always, I'd like to thank Becky for her work on Spotlight, arranging things, and on this occasion to Dennis for actually recording the programme for us for later transmission. Okay, well, today I've got someone very interesting for you to meet. He's a relative newcomer on for the people, known as Tip Tap on the site, but his real name is Dave Kent. And Dave, can I start by thanking you to agree to be interviewed and begin by asking you where and when you were born?
Okay. Hi, Steve. Hello, everybody else. Hope you can hear me well. Okay, my name is Dave Kent, and I was born in 1959 in a city, well, it was a town in those days, called Swansea in South Wales, in South West Wales to be exact, which is about 190 to 200 miles west of London. Yep, 40 this Christmas.
What about family members, Dave, brothers and sisters?
Okay, I'm the youngest of six. I've got two brothers and three sisters, but in terms of visual impairment, I'm the only one with any kind of visual impairment.
Okay, and your parents, what did your parents do, mum and dad?
Well, I came from good working class stock. My father was from London and moved to Wales just before the war, and met my mother, who was from Wales, and ended up staying down here. Preferred Wales to the hurly-burly of London. My father was a white-collar worker and was a supervisor in a telephone exchange, and the old GPO in Britain, that was the General Post Office. My mother did ancillary work and worked at the wet end of a hospital laundry in one of the hospitals in Swansea. That's kind of a potted history of them.
And could you tell the listeners in the room here a little bit about the area in which you grew up? I'm stating the obvious, but of course Wales is not England. I know some people get confused, but of course you are not. It isn't England. So could you just give us a feel for the area in which you spent your early years? What was the place like?
Dylan Thomas once quoted Swansea as being a lovely, ugly town. And, well, I suppose it is, yeah. And there are others that called it a pretty shitty city. But an ugly, lovely town sounds okay. Swansea, yeah, tucked away in the southwest corner of southwest Wales, was founded on industry and was founded on copper, actually. It used to be the biggest producer of processing copper, smelting copper in the world, and was the biggest exporter of anthracite coal in the world right throughout the 18th and 19th century. So it's a town, well, a city on a river, the River Towy, which flows into Swansea Bay. Swansea Bay is part of the Bristol Channel. So all around from Swansea, right up along the South Wales conurbation to Cardiff, Newport, is heavily industrialised with steel and, well, formerly coal, but not anymore. The rest of Wales is predominantly rural. So it was always South Wales that was the industrial kind of heartland of Wales, and the financial kind of economic powerhouse of this part of Britain.
Fine, that's giving people a feel, because I always like to know a little bit about the area. Of course, I was more familiar with you and your surroundings than I am with some of the American guests we have. So hopefully that's been of interest to them to know the sort of area in which you were born and brought up. You said that you are the only member of the family with a visual problem. Do you have any sight at all, or are you totally blind, Dave?
In terms of vision, no. I've got no perception of light now. I did have vision once before. I'll give you a little description of that as well. Just to say that after describing Swansea as being heavily industrialised, well, it was, but not any longer. And all around Swansea has always been the most beautiful countryside and beaufort bays and everything on the Gower Peninsula. So you've got this kind of mixture of industry and then places of outstanding natural beauty. Sorry, Steve, but I can't remember the question. We were going back to the... Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, no perception of light. And that was following some surgery I had in 1978, which was supposed to give me some more vision in my left eye, which was the only eye I could see out of. I was born with bilateral congenital cataracts, which means cataracts over both eyes, before birth. And after having surgery when I was a child, I could see enough to ride a bike and read large print, and I didn't have to use a mobility aid, a cane or a dog. But in 1978, I had this operation that was supposed to make things better and supposed to improve the vision I had in my eye, in my left eye. Unfortunately, it went catastrophically wrong, and after a lot of things like retinal detachment surgery, reconstructive surgery, post-surgical glaucoma, acute glaucoma, it rendered me ultimately totally blind, and now no perception of light.
What are your early childhood memories before school? What sort of things do you remember about your early days?
Well, not too much really. I've got scant memories of my early childhood. At the age of 2, I was taken away from home and put into what they call a sunshine home, which was a blind kindergarten, really, for blind and special needs kids. It was deemed that it was probably within my best interests that I was taken away from the family and put into this place where good things could be taught to me, I think, and I would have the best chance for a start in life. You know, that's open to conjecture, I think. So, very few early memories. I think one of my earliest memories is travelling back to this place, which is about 20 miles east of Swansea, travelling back on a cold bus on a rainy Sunday evening, and I can remember having my face pressed to the glass, watching the raindrops trickle down the window of the bus through the streetlights. And that seriously is one of my earliest memories, and knowing that I was going back to this place and going away from home. I must have been about, what, 3, I suppose? 3, 3 and a half? And one of my other earliest memories is driving along in a pedal car in this place. Hazy, gauzy memories.
Yeah. I think we all went through that sort of experience of the sunshine home. They're far from sunny, from what I remember, but that's my experience and not yours. So eventually I take it you went to a residential school for the blind, and where was that?
Oh dear, dear, dear. Yeah, okay. At 4 and a half, I left the kind of the relative bosom of sanctuary at the sunshine home. And I was incarcerated for the next 11 and a half years in this Dickensian hellhole called Ysgol Penybont, which was a school for the blind in Bridgend, which is about 21 miles east of Swansea. It was a terrible place where the emphasis was not so much on education, but on containment. It was the most, well, I suppose, unimaginative kind of awful places where, yeah, there was just such low expectation of anybody that it's a wonder anybody succeeded in anything after leaving that place. Yeah, terrible, terrible place. But in those days, we had no choice, because if you were the parent of a blind child, you had no choice. There was no such thing as integrated education then. Kids with special needs, in my case, you know, visual disability, being educated in mainstream schools. That wasn't even heard of. So you had no choice at all. Your parents had no choice at all. You were sent away from school, sent away to school, which probably is one of the most singularly most destructive acts you could ever perform on a child.
Yeah, from what you say, my next question was going to be, did you enjoy your time at school? But I think you've just about answered that for us, Dave. Were you academically bright? You know, were you stretched at all? Or from what you say, they didn't really push you very hard. Do you think you could have been pushed a bit harder? And did you enjoy any aspect of your studies?
Okay, in terms of academic achievement, I've not got a degree. We had this sick, crazy thing in Britain that used to be called the 11 plus. And what the 11 plus was kids who were going through schools were filtered into two channels after doing this exam called the 11 plus. Those that passed the 11 plus went on to grammar schools or, you know, to kind of streamed to an academic school career. And those that didn't kind of found their way into industry and other kind of less academic pursuits. In Britain, we have this blind grammar school, this residential blind school called Worcester College for the Blind. And that's where you would go if you passed your 11 plus. I went up to Worcester to take this 11 plus and failed it. I don't know why I failed it. I must have been reasonably bright for them to put me up to the exam in the first place. And they couldn't understand, the school couldn't understand why I'd failed this exam. And with some cajoling from the school and pushing from my dad a little bit, I took the exam again the next year and failed it again. And there was all kinds of, you know, shenanigans following that. They really couldn't understand why the hell I hadn't passed this exam. And I was sent to see various educational psychologists at the University of Swansea to find out if I was, you know, what was going on. And they couldn't understand, you know, because my IQ was okay. I think it must have been I probably didn't like Worcester College at that time and maybe didn't want to go there. So subconsciously threw out messages to kind of stop me from going there. I left school with no exams. And would very much love to study now. You know, going into my mid-40s, I will go back to do a degree, and it'll be at my choosing, at my time, with no, with no pushing. As I said, in blind school, in the school that I went to, the blind school in Bridgend, there was not much encouragement. Well, there was virtually no encouragement. Punishment. It was a very pernicious environment. And kind of didn't inspire one with a lot of confidence, really, to go on to study. There were a couple of leading lights in the school. There was my history teacher, who was very strict, very dry, but a good teacher, and gave me a feeling for social history, which will be a component of my degree. And my music and drama teacher, who came to the school when I was 10, and was like, well, quite frankly, like a breath of fresh air coming to the school, and inspired me to go on to do a lot of what I'd done subsequently. And of course my gym teacher, because it was always fun to kind of go swimming or go to the sea or run around the track or play soccer or a bit of rugby or whatever. And we made canoes from scratch, from fiberglass, and then took them to various rivers and bays to sail them. So there was a lot of activity that he generated, and that was good. So yeah, history, physical education, and music drama were the things I excelled in. Left school at 16 with no qualifications, and went on to college to study to be a dun, 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 a piano tuner.
Okay. I was going to ask you what you did after leaving school. So you left school and you went to be a piano tuner. Did that last long, that training?
What, did the career last long, or did the course take long? No, the course was 3 years. Three wasted years. Because I never wanted to be a piano tuner. I was squeezed through the institutional sausage machine into this kind of this other blind institution where they would train you to be a piano tuner. It was called the Royal Normal College for the Blind. There was nothing normal about it. Should have been the Royal Abnormal College for the Blind. And I qualified as a piano tuner technician and practiced for 5 months, and it really drove me nuts. And I never wanted to do it in the first place. When I told them what I wanted to do, they laughed at me and told me not to be such a silly boy and to get on with my life.
Oh, that's a good leading for a question, if ever I heard one. But before we come on to that, what did you do in your teenage years then? Did you amuse yourself? Did you go out with your mates? Had you made friends at home by then, after you'd left college and so on? What sort of a teenage years did you have?
Well, I was fortunate in that I could come home for the weekends and holidays, and my contemporaries in the street that I grew up with always accepted me for who I was, really, and kind of unlike the story of some of my other contemporaries in school who went home and were basically sheltered and weren't allowed to go out and didn't mix with people of their own age in the street, fully sighted kids in the street, I was very lucky in that I did, and I did everything with them and kind of, it was a case of, Dave's blind, well, so what, kind of thing. So I was lucky in that respect. So I was in socialized normally after coming from this kind of chaotic environment, which was blind school, into a reasonably normal, kind of residential area.
That's good to know. And after a little while, what was the next significant turning point in your life after this period? Because you did say that when they told you what you wanted to do, and I do know what you do, they laughed at you. What was the next significant turning point in your life?
I think picking up the reins at 18, I had an operation when I was 18 that was supposed to make the vision that I had better, but as I said earlier on, it was it went catastrophically wrong, and that was at 18. So I think that kind of began to sink in and filter in that I'd got serious problems here with my sight, and I couldn't see what I could before, and that the prognosis wasn't very good, and that eventually it was going to lead to total blindness. So I suppose I began to fall apart in those days and disintegrate in a way, because there I was, this very active kid with a disability, with a visual disability, that didn't really get in the way. And hey, there I was at 18 going blind with my dad deteriorating quite rapidly with Parkinson's disease, having been squeezed through this institution and then expected to kind of function in the real world, as they used to call it, the real world, after being provided with very few skills to be able to do that. I think I spent the next 3 or 4 years just basically kind of disintegrating and coming to terms with slowly with what it meant to be, what it was to be really blind. I had a few attempts at going back to study in an adult education environment, but I couldn't study, I couldn't concentrate, I didn't know how to learn, I think I'd never been shown how to learn. So that kind of died a death, and it was all a bit up and down, to say the least. And it was in about 1986, when I'd met somebody on the underground system in London, on the subway, as you call it, we call it the tube, and I met somebody who was helping me down onto the train with my guide dog, I'm a guide dog handler of 24 years now. And she said, what do you do? And I said, not too much. And she said, what would you like to do? And I said, oh, I'd really enjoy drama and that, and music. And she said, oh, have you ever heard of Grey Eye Theatre Company? And I said, yeah, I'd heard of them. And she said, oh, well, have you ever considered coming along to one of the workshops, one of the open workshops for the Grey Eye Theatre Company Amateur Dramatic Workshops? And I went, no. So I was invited to go, and pretty soon I kind of got involved with Grey Eye Theatre Company. And Grey Eye, spelled G-R-A-E-A-E, and it comes from the Greek, the three sisters of Grey Eye, who were the Gorgons, who had one eye and one tooth between them. And I think it was Perseus, who stole the eye, who tricked them into lending him the eye, so he could find out where the Gorgon was, the Medusa was, to slay her. And he tricked them into lending her eye, and he refused to give it back until they told him where the Medusa was, so he could go and slay it. Well, anyway, that's the history behind the name Grey Eye from Greek mythology. I went along to the amateur workshops and got involved with that, and joined another company soon after that, called Double Exposure, and that was a professional company, and I got my equity card, which I think you've got equity in the United States as well, but it's the Actors Union card, and it's quite difficult to get an equity card, but what it means basically is you can work in the business. You have automatic passage into kind of auditions and interviews. If you haven't got an equity card, you can't work. If you have, you can work. And then a series of theatre companies after that, workshops, drama workshops, worked in theatre and education for a while, other drama-y stuff.
Has you always had an ambition, maybe a secret ambition, to go into drama? Is it something that you excelled at in your early life? Have you always had a fascination for the theatre? Or did it come to you and you thought, oh, well, maybe this is something I can actually do and give it a shot? Because I think Grey Eye are primarily all visually handicapped people, or people with a visual impairment. Aren't they, Dave? Am I right there? Did this come to you like a bolt out of the blue, or had you got ambitions, or maybe you didn't even realise it, maybe subconsciously since you were a child?
You're kind of almost right with Grey Eye. Grey Eye is Europe's premier professional theatre company for actors with disabilities. So there's a kind of a range of disabilities, from sensory to physical disabilities. Ever since I was a baby, I suppose, ever since I could talk and walk, I've been singing songs and I used to love doing accents and things when I was a child and kind of putting on voices and doing stupid things and playing up. And I always enjoyed telly and films, TV and films and that. But it wasn't until I was 10, as I said, when this music and drama teacher, Kathy Phipps, came to the school, and she brought a breath of fresh air into this kind of dark hole. And she had a lot of ideas and a lot of imagination, and brought instruments in the school that we could shake and bang and play. And she put on drama, put on concerts and shows, of which I took an active role. And I think pretty soon, I discovered that, yeah, I really love this. And with her encouragement, I'd get really, really good and get good roles, like, I don't know, Fagin in Oliver, or, Toad in Toad of Toad Hall, and kind of just brilliant characters like that. So I think it's always been in my blood. Apparently my great-grandmother was, and my great-grandmother and her mother before her were theatre people. So maybe it's a genetic thing. So yeah, from 10, that's when it really started to flourish.
When you decided to become a professional actor, did you have any formal training? If so, where? And I'm sure if you did have any formal training, you probably found some prejudice. Just tell us how you transferred from amateur to professional.
Formal training would have been a luxury. Unfortunately, when I applied to go to drama school, it was in the dark, enlightened, you know, unenlightened days. And after applying to RADA, the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts, at 16, I was told that I wouldn't be able to do the stage course because of my disability. And that's the way it's always been. Up till fairly recently, blind people have never had access to drama schools, because it's deemed that you wouldn't be able to, you know, you wouldn't be able to cope. So the only education in drama that blind people have had access to till recently has been university drama courses, and that would be something like English with drama, or, you know, music with drama. It's not a specifically a drama course, you know, an acting course, as it would be in, say, RADA or Rose Bruford or the Central School of Speech and Drama, which are established world-famous drama schools. So no, I mean, I didn't have I didn't have the opportunity of going to drama school as much as I would have loved to. So it's all a felt thing, and I've lived off my wits, and you know, my art comes from within inside me rather than being taught it. And I missed that. I would have liked to have gone to drama school, because it would have been nice to have this raw talent polished and focused and honed down and fashioned into something sharper than probably what it is now. So it's, yeah, it's on my wits. I've got my work, really.
Have you ever managed to work in theatre on stage? And if you have, can you tell us a little bit about how you cope with stage presence, how you know where things are in relation to your fellow actors or the props and things like that? Have you done theatre work?
Oh, yes, indeedy. I think if you're going to do any kind of work like this, I think you've got to be reasonably sussed and reasonably aware of your spatial environment, of wherever your spatial environment happens to be. And what I do, as soon as we walk into the theatre, well, it starts from the rehearsal stages, really, from the workshopping stages and from the rehearsal halls. And I walk the stage. I walk it and walk it and walk the area. Even if it's a square with nothing on the floor, it's just this square or a rectangle or whatever the stage area is, I'll walk it and walk it and walk it until I've got it firmly fixed. Then, of course, there comes the set afterwards. And I work with the set. So, again, I'll kind of work it and walk it and walk it and work it until I know where everything is. In terms of where my fellow actors are, well, that comes through the rehearsal process anyway, and we call that blocking. That's when where people are at a certain point in the piece, what they're saying, where they are. So yeah, one learns a lot kind of that way. And also, what I do is, underneath the carpet on stage, or whatever the floor covering is on stage, I have what's called sash cord, which is a kind of, how would I describe sash cord? It's like a piece of plaited rope, about a half an inch diameter, that's put underneath the kind of the floor covering and gaffered to the floor. So you lay this down across the stage in lines that you can feel under your feet when you're walking, but they can't be seen by members of the public. So, for instance, you'd put three or four lines of this, like, thin rope at the front of the stage. You were walking towards the front of the stage. You'd be able to feel it, and you'd know you were coming to the front of the stage. And there'd be various kind of, you know, little clues like this underfoot that only I would know about. So it makes the kind of the movement, it makes the movement on stage a lot more fluid, and also kind of gives you a hell of a lot of confidence. So little tricks of the trade. In terms of props, again, it's just learning where things are. It's just approach. It's a process of habituation and repetition, which you just become second nature then, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does, Dave. It makes a lot of sense. That's very, very interesting. Now, something that I've always found fascinating about actors is how on earth do you remember all those lines? How do you learn your lines, you know, as a blind person? Can you just share with us some of your tricks of the trade?
In terms of remembering scripts and learning lines and that, well, that's kind of the bane of anybody's life, really. And if you're blind, it's doubly difficult because you really do have to scan every word in Braille. And I use Braille. I use a mixture. Well, I use three methods, really. I use Braille, I use a print script with a seeing person, and I'll use a tape recorder as well as a kind of a prompting aid. So for instance, if I get a script now for TV, what I do is get the film company or the TV company to email me the script. This is the wonders of modern technology now, such as what we are using now. And I get my script sent to me in an email. I'll print it out in Braille from a Braille printer and work like that. The only thing about getting a script as a blind actor is, unlike seeing people, we can't scan the page and make sense of it like that to do a first-off read-through. You have to get the script in advance. So even though you might not have learnt the script off by heart, you know, it gives you a bit of time to get familiar with the script, so you can make some sense of it, so you can bring some sort of character to a read-through. And obviously then, you know, as the rehearsal process goes on, so you learn your lines. Those are the three methods that I use.
And how do you interact with the other actors, and how do they interact with you? I imagine there aren't too many totally blind actors around, professional actors. So when they first see you for the first time, how do they react?
Well, I've had a mixed bag, really. I mean, I've got to say, I've been lucky in that I've done some pioneering work in terms of, especially a blind actor on mainstream network television and film. There are very few of us professional blind actors. And yeah, a mixed bag. You get some people that are very switched on and, you know, are completely cool and sussed about the whole thing. And it's no big deal. It's, okay, well, that's Dave, and, you know, Dave's blind and he's an actor. You know, or he's an actor and he's blind. And then you'll get other companies that will make a big deal of it. And it's, you know, it's everything. And that can be a bit stifling, really. And there are the others then that kind of sit in the fence and that, you know, a little bit distant. I'm lucky in that most of what I've done throughout my career has been working with some great people, some really switched on people. Actors, again, you know, fellow actors, it's a mixed bag. People that are really sussed and people that are terrified, absolutely terrified. And I was working on a series called Noah's Ark, which was a nice family series that went out on network television on ITV in this country, independent television in this country, on a Friday evening at 8 o'clock. So it's a nice, safe family drama called Noah's Ark. And it's set in the English Midlands, in Worcestershire, for our North American friends. Or Worcestershire, and it's a series about a vet, about a country veterinary surgeon, and I played this guy who was just about to have his dog retired, and he didn't want his guy dog retired. He wanted to hang on to this dog for as long as he could, and the vet's going, oh, come on now, you know, come on now, Joe, isn't it about time you gave that poor dog up now, and had enough, and got, you know, really upset about it and defensive about the whole thing. And it's kind of a sad part, Well, no, a bit like a curate's egg, good in part, happy and sad, a bit of a weepy. But the guy who plays the veterinary surgeon is a well-known old British thespian, a real old lovey, and working with two fine actors, Angela Thorne and Anton Rogers, who played this vet. And on the very last day of this particular series that I'd worked on, he came up to me after we'd cut and canned it and said, Dave, it's been wonderful working with you, and do you know, it's just like working with a real actor. My co-actor wanted to belt him, but I held him back.
Another obvious tool of your trade, Dave, is to portray emotions. And I'm just thinking, as a blind person, how do you portray emotion with your body language and your facial expression if you've never really seen body language and facial expression?
I think that in many cases, I think that a lot of facial gestures and a lot of kind of stuff is pretty universal if you're blind or if you're sighted. In terms of posture, I've always had a kind of a straight posture, and I think it comes from being able to see once upon a time when I did have useful vision. So I suppose I subconsciously relate back to that. I'm fortunate in that I've been able to see, so maybe I'm mimicking, mimicking that really, or acting out that. I've never really thought about it. I've always been of the opinion that, well, if it feels right inside, then hopefully it looks right outside. And obviously it does, because, every now and again the phone rings, so I still get the work, so I must be all right. I played blind characters, but I did a three-part drama series set in the Great War, where I played a guy who was blinded through mustard gas and trauma. And there were scenes where we were in the trenches, where I was sighted, and I used prosthetic shells anyway, over my ordinary eyes, which are quite scarred and stuff through the surgery and through the glaucoma. And I wear these acrylic prosthetic shells that, as you all know, look extremely kind of realistic. On the set, I just learned where things were. I got my bearings, and there I was charging about with a pack and bayonet and rifle and things like that. There wasn't any actors around me. They were all about 50 yards away from me on either side. Nobody would come near me. I couldn't understand why. I only had a rifle and a bayonet. What possible danger is there with a blind person brandishing a rifle and bayonet? But well, anyway, needless to say, I was a singleton on the set around that time. But no, I think an inner truth manifests itself in an outer truth, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does make sense, Dave. And are you ever given any directions by the director? I know directors are notorious for telling actors what to do, and actors are notorious for telling directors what they think. But do they ever instruct you on how you should stand, or how you should look, or how you should gesture?
Yeah, good question. Again, it depends on your governor. It depends on your boss, on your director. And you'll get some who want to be really hands-on, and there are others that will stand back and go, well, look, what do you think? Do it your way. I'm not really that fussed. As long as it looks reasonably all right. I always kind of get a process of dialogue going, so it's a reciprocal arrangement, and there's reciprocity right throughout the kind of the process, and there's an input from me, and there's an input from them, and with a constructive dialogue, we can come to a happy medium and get the best out of me. Really, some directors are better at doing it than others. Some are very natural, some are very forced. But yeah, I mean, it's a thing of me saying, okay, what does this look like? Or, the boss going, don't ever do that again, forget it. That looks great, Dave, keep that, do that. So yeah, I mean, dialogue is the answer there, Steve.
Okay, that's understood. You said a little while ago that you'd worked on TV and you've done films. Just as a general interest, nothing to do with blindness, but can you just talk us through that process of shooting a scene? From what I'm led to understand, it's very bitty and it can take forever to do one scene or even part of a scene. Just talk us through what actually happens when you're actually filming a shot.
Well, even before you get to the set, there's two things to go through. There's wardrobe, where you'll go and get dressed. You know, you'll have dressers there who dress you. You know, get your costume sorted out. And you'll go from that caravan then. You'll go to the, you know, you'll go to makeup. And for instance, when I was shooting Unknown Soldier, because they had to recreate the blast injuries from the mustard gas, the burns and everything, my makeup would take about an hour and a half. So I'd get what they call a unit call at 4:30 in the morning, where they'd send a car for me. It's very, very swish. They'd send a limo at 4:30 in the morning, and then you'd be sitting in makeup at 6 o'clock in the morning for the next hour and a half, before you even got to the set. Then there would probably be about another hour and a half to 2 to 3 hours hanging around while they're getting the scene, you know, they get the scene set up, because it takes a while to get the, you know, to get the scene set, then to get all the camera equipment in, and cameras run on rails, you know, they have to get the rails sorted out, you know, get the lighting sorted out, and that takes a hell of a lot. So there's all of this kind of, you know, pre-production time. When you actually get onto the set and work the scene, that's over in a flash, really. Well, hopefully, usually. And they shoot the scene from different angles. So you might have to do the same scene 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 times. Shooting it from different angles, getting different kind of lighting on it, things like this. You know, you'll do the shot, and then the boss will have a look at it, you know, and he'll consult with his people, and then he'll go, yeah, okay, we'll keep that, or we'll do that again, or can you try this, and we'll do that. It takes a long time. I think it was Charlie Watts from the Rolling Stones said, you know, look, you know, this business, and I'm involved, you know, I've been in the music business for years as well, and it really is, literally, hurry, hurry, wait. There's a lot of sitting around. Hurry, hurry, wait.
Yeah, I thought that was probably the case. Now, thinking about a blind actor and thinking about how we all love listening to radio, I should think the perfect medium maybe for a blind actor is radio work. Have you done any radio work?
Yeah, I first started working in hospital radio many, many years ago in Swansea when I was at home here. And I always wanted to work in either TV, film, theatre or radio, or I wanted to sing in a band, you know, and kind of make records. And that was when in school they told me not to be such a silly boy and to I'd be much better off being a piano tuner. So yeah, radio, hospital radio when I was a teenager. Then nothing at all. I didn't do anything until about 1991, when I first started getting involved with the BBC, British Broadcasting Corporation. And I started working on a program for blind and visual impaired people on National Network Radio called In Touch. And I started working on the In Touch program and gradually did more and more and more. Went off and did a radio production course and then joined the staff at the BBC working on various programs on In Touch, on a holiday program, on a news and current affairs program, consumer current affairs program called You and Yours. And also, I presented a series on network radio on Radio 3. And that was Britain's first magazine program for blind teenagers, with a mainstream appeal as well. So, you know, it was good for blind and seeing kids. And I freelance now, and radio is an important part of my life, as it is with many blind people. radio, the love of radio for me goes back to taking a transistor radio to school and sneaking it under the pillows in boarding school when I was 7 and 8 years old. So I grew up with radio, and I grew up with speech-based radio. I think radio is a very intelligent medium. TV is very glamorous, and it's a lot of fun, and it's worth a lot of money when you work in. And there's the kudos of, you know, kind of people seeing you because you're highly visible. And you're blind, and because there are not many blind actors on TV, you know, you kind of get spotted. And so there's that. But in terms of preference, I think radio's got a spontaneity that TV hasn't got. And it demands more of the participant. You know, it demands more from the listener. It demands more from the broadcaster. And yeah, it's an adult medium, I think, an intelligent medium.
Have you ever done any radio drama or radio adverts? And if not, would you like to?
I've done radio dramas, yeah. I love radio drama. Yeah, I've been lucky like that as well. Done stuff for the BBC Rep and stuff like that. Yeah, I've been lucky like that. I love it. Adverts, no, but I'd like to do some voiceovers. It's not a medium that I've exploited, really. I've done TV adverts, for beer. I've done a beer commercial and stuff like that. But radio, no.
Are you scared at all of being typecast as the blind actor? Do you foresee a problem there? Or have you been able to play sighted roles? Well, we know you've played sighted roles because you've told us, but is there a bit of a fear in the back of your mind that you're going to be typecast?
I don't mind, because I am what I am, you know. I'm Dave Kent, I'm an actor, and I'm blind. You know, I haven't got a problem with that. And if I'm the blind actor, then fine. It means that I'm getting the work, or another blind actor's getting the work, and not a seeing person, because I also believe passionately in positive casting. You know, I don't think it's good enough these days that sighted people that get to play actors with disabilities, when there are a wealth of talented actors with disabilities out there. So there's the politics of that I'm passionately interested in. I'm not saying that able-bodied actors should never play characters with disabilities. No, I'm not saying that. But I think that actors with disabilities should have a fair bite of the cherry, first of all. But in terms of me being stereotyped and typecast, no, I haven't got a problem with that. Yeah, I don't mind. If it brings in the money, dear boy, then, I'll be a slut. Well, you know, to an extent. There are some things I won't do.
Yeah, we get the message, Dave. What would you say so far has been the best role you've had, the best part you've played so far in your career, and why?
The best role in theatre was, I think it would have to be either Toad in Toad of Toad Hall, the stage adaptation of Kenneth Graham's Wind in the Willows, which is a marvellous, marvellous kind of piece to play and a book to read. And I would urge anybody that isn't familiar with that book to read it, the Wind in the Willows. In adult theatre, I did a Joe Orton play where I played this commissioner for asylums, this government psychiatrist, who was a complete and utter lunatic, a real lunatic. And a lot of meat and bread in that character. And very tiring, but a fascinating role to play. Completely barking mad, you know, like two cymbals short of a drum kit. You know, he's bizarre. As were a lot of Joe Orton's characters in his farces. That was in a play called What the Butler Saw. TV, two things spring out at me immediately. Unknown Soldier, which is that three-part drama series in the Great War, which was fantastic. And to look at my bookshelf now in my living room, or in my lounge, or sitting room, as you call it, there's a lot of literature up there about the social history of the Great War. So, and to play that, you know, to play a character like that, to have the opportunity to play a character like that was indeed a wonderful gift. And also, I played a guy called Martin Stevens in a film called Scaligrig with Ian Dury from Ian Dury and the Blockheads fame and other eminent kind of old British thespes. About a guy who was incarcerated in a lunatic asylum from the age of 7 in 1927 up until the 1980s and the subsequent abuse that that was dealt out to him whilst in this institution. I played this guy called Martin Stevens, who was a real Jack the Lad. That was a great film to play because of the subject matter, and also because of the people that I was the people that I was fortunate enough to be able to work with on that film. Yeah, and there's the music, of course. You know, there's the band stuff as well. And that's kind of the you know, that's the kind of the ceiling strand, really.
Yeah, we'll come on to the musical side of it in a moment, Dave. But I'm interested in how, as an actor, you can psych yourself up to play a part. Supposing it's you know, 7 o'clock on a cold, wet Tuesday morning, which it usually is over here, of course, and you've got to come up with the goods. Is it difficult to psych yourself up to play your part? And there must be occasions when you don't really feel like doing it, especially if you're in the theatre and you've done it lots of times before. How on earth do you manage to get yourself psyched up to come up with the goods?
I don't know. I think you have these. You're absolutely right. You know, there are times where you just feel like the last thing I want to be doing is going up to you know, going up to Hartlepool in the frozen north or of England on a wet Tuesday night. You know, only then to have to drive to you know, to some godforsaken town in the middle of Wales. You know, in the cold, to do this character again, where you might have an audience of I don't know, about 15 people. Or other nights you might get a full house, you know, of 500 people. You know, and sometimes you really, really have to dig deep to get to the reserves. You know, I'd say that the wine and drugs helped, but not anymore. No, I mean, seriously, there are those that do that. No, I think it just comes from within you. I think you do have these reserves, and you call on them, and you just make sure that when you're not working, you build up your reserves, so you've got it. You know, you've got enough of it to draw on when times are hard and you need that.
Would you say it's true also that some actors are actors because they're trying to hide beneath a mask? They don't really want people to know the real person, so if they can play different parts, they can keep their themselves to themselves. I've heard that said. Is that any truth in that?
I've seen, yeah, there are those characters, you know, and you can see through that. I'm not one for that, really. I'm me, and I just, you know, people take me as I am. I don't try and hide, because, you know, I like to consider myself to be an accessible person. I mean, obviously, there's a private part of me, but mostly I'm a pretty kind of down-to-earth, genuine kind of a bloke. And I've met some lovely people who are of a likewise disposition in the business. And I always say, in whatever branch of this business, whether it be the theatre, whether it be television, radio, the music business, people fall into two kind of categories in the main. And they're either absolutely fantastic, or they're complete kind of, well, you just wouldn't want to know them. And there's not an awful lot of grey area in between, really.
Well, the time's marching on now, Dave, and there's one or two points I would like to cover with you before we wind up the interview. We've had one or two problems, but we've overcome them. Have you got any ambition? What is your biggest ambition in the acting profession? Is there a role which you'd really love to do?
Yeah, I'd like to do anything that involves kind of historical kind of fictionary, like factual fictional history based on fact. So yeah, I mean, I don't know, you know, can't immediately think of a role that would buzz me, but villainy. I'm interested in villainy. I'm interested in vice, and I'd like to play I'd like to play a Mr. Nasty. Just to break the stereotypes of blind people being passive, being this and that. I'd like to play a really nasty piece of work. But that again, you know, I'd love to play, and have played, completely different roles. Sensitive, warm roles. Characters that flow with the milk of human kindness and understanding. I'll play anything within reason, as long as the part is right, and as long as the money is right.
Yeah. Now, you have mentioned during the course of the interview your music, we haven't really got much time left, but can you just briefly tell us about the band you play in? I know you do play in a band. Just give us a feel for what you do with the band, and what the band's called, etc.
Yeah, I play with a band called The Men They Couldn't Hang, which was a Celtic rock folk outfit formed in 1984, who had a number one album with The Night of a Thousand Candles in 1984. And I began to work with The Men They Couldn't Hang in 1989, and did my first album with them in 1990. And then through the 90s, culminating in an album that we just finished mixing last Friday night, and that will be released in the spring, called Cherry Red Jukebox, and we think it's the best album we've ever made. Also, I'm in the studio, back in the studio in about a month, working on my own material, which is slightly different. And that's for a four-track CD single. Bands, you know, it's really important to me. The musical side of my career is extremely important to me. I've also had my best laughs in that business as well, and, you know, I've been fortunate to kind of do European tours, British tours, and hopefully with this next album we'll go back to Canada and the States to tour it.
What sort of music do you play? What sort of music does the band feature?
Well, the band is conscious lyrics. We promote, we're kind of socialist anarchist by definition, I suppose, really politically. So, you know, I mean, it's conscious lyrics. Don't get me wrong, when I say, we promote international socialism, you know, we're not communists, we're socialists by design. So the music in former times has been overtly political. For instance, on our second album, we'd have songs like The Ghosts of Cable Street, which was a ballad telling about anti-fascist activity and people who stood up against fascists in the 1930s in London and stuff like that. You know, it was a kind of a biographical, historical biographical kind of tale of what went on there. Company Town on our Silvertown album would be a song, for instance, about corporatization, you know, about how you walk into any town in any high street now, or any shopping mall in Britain and North America, and you'll see the same shops. You know, you'll see McDonald's, Burger King, Topshop, Blockbuster Video, and how our towns and cities are all owned now by multinational kind of corporate conglomerates. So, I mean, our songs in times gone by were railing against that sort of stuff. Now, kind of 18 years later, the songs now are stories about people, and they're sensitive observations and stories about the people we meet now and their characters and their stories, rather than kind of bugling political statements, which are all very well, you know, and have their place. But it's the next stage on in the kind of the, you know, the band's, you know, the band's writing material. And my own stuff is a lot softer. My own stuff, you know, I want to be doing pop ballads and great songs that people can sing at the, you know, whether they're in the office or the factory or they're in their car or wherever. You know, my own ambition now is to create sensitive and kind of just nice, well-crafted, intelligent, middle-of-the-road songs, I suppose, like the best ballads we've all heard and, you know, we can all sing.
Well, Dave, thank you very much indeed for agreeing to be interviewed on Spotlight. I'm sure we've all learned a great deal about your craft, and may I and everyone connected with other people wish you every success in the future and more power to you. You're doing a great job, Dave, and thanks once again.